5 days ago, the Washington Post asked Dr. Laura Forman to describe conditions in her Rhode Island emergency department.
I think the first word that comes to mind is disastrous.
Put your hand in the stretcher, honey. Thank you.
Overwhelming, frightening, disheartening. Omicron being so much more contagious has made it really difficult. With Delta, we'd have a couple of staff out. This is unlike anything else we've seen.
Are you having any difficulty breathing?
Yeah.
Okay, where are you having difficulty breathing? Okay, look at me.
Any nausea or vomiting?
We are struggling and at times failing to take care of the people who come through the door because of lack of staffing, because of lack of space, because of lack of resources.
As best you can for me. Big breath in.
It's worse partly because we're seeing more patients. It's worse partly because the hospital is so full. It's worse because we don't have staff, because we've lost so much staff.
Breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth, okay? You're going to be okay, sweetheart, okay? Just stay breathing for me. Can we have that stretcher?
It's right here.
Like, either I take care of someone in a car or I don't get to take care of them at all. Or either I take care of them in the waiting room or they don't get care at all. Or they wait 10 hours for care. You know, we've had people wait 10 or 12 hours to be seen. And if you're here for an emergency, that's untenable.
That sound is from when Dr. Laura Forman spoke with the Washington Post last Thursday. On that day, Rhode Island recorded one of the highest rates of new COVID infections in the country, according to the Post. By yesterday, the number of new cases in the state had dropped by more than 15%. So we checked in with Dr. Forman again.
These last couple of days, it feels like maybe we're starting to get a little bit of a breather. I hesitate to forecast too much. You know, we're all hoping that we're just at the crest now and it'll be downhill from here. But I got to tell you, this virus is kind of like a whack-a-mole. We think we've got it knocked down and it just comes right back up again. And so I'm a little too superstitious to say that we're coming into the clear. You know, it does seem like maybe things are starting to plateau right now in Rhode Island, but who knows what tonight and tomorrow will bring.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Dr. Forman is the emergency department chief at Kent Hospital in Warwick, Rhode Island. It's a medium-sized hospital that had been doing fairly well before the pandemic. In fact, from 2016 to 2019, according to the Washington Post, Kent Hospital closed its ER waiting room because every patient was being seen within minutes. There was no need for a waiting room. Over the past week, though, that wait has stretched to 10 or 12 hours. 20% of the people who come through the ER's doors grow so tired of the wait, they're leaving. That pains Dr. Forman, but she told us she's clear about how important it is for people to try to stay safe and out of the ER right now.
We don't want people doing things that would have a higher likelihood of ending them up here. I'm telling all of my friends, do not take up skiing right now. Now is not the time to do any kind of risky behavior. Now is not the time to take up a new sport. Now is not the time to maybe see if you can make it down the back stairs without shoveling them. Do not go tubing tonight. Nothing that involves ice and absolutely nothing that involves alcohol and any sort of form of motion. That is a sure shot to end up in the emergency department. I would also stay away from any sort of situations that might end up in a brawl. We don't need that right now. I don't want anybody getting hurt. I don't want anybody getting sick who would end up in the ER and add additional burden.
There is no slack in the Kent Hospital ER. None. Nursing vacancies have been as high as 50%, with staff falling sick or burning out. And last week, there weren't enough staff to cover the hospital's 359 beds. There were enough nurses and doctors to care for patients in only 199 of those beds. As a result, patients in the emergency department wait for days for a bed to open up. This is a practice known as boarding, and we'll hear a lot more about it later. Dr. Forman has worked in emergency departments around the world, Europe, Africa, Central America. And she says the pandemic didn't cause the problem in Kent's ER. It inflamed issues that were already there.
At its best before the pandemic, hospital staffing was always a tight thing. We always try and not be too overstaffed. We always try and have just enough staff to take care of the patients who come in. Now, during the pandemic, we're really stretched pretty thin. And so we're trying to have people stay as safe as they possibly can and keep out of the hospital when they safely can.
A tight thing. try not to be too overstaffed. Just enough staff. These are things you just heard Dr. Foreman say, and they are the hallmarks of an efficiency model of care, where in the best of times, staffing margins can be thin, 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 but still effective in both nonprofit hospitals like Kent and for-profit hospitals elsewhere. However, a system built to maximize efficiency is not one that's built to weather disruptions, small or large.
My silver lining in the pandemic, my great hope in this is that the pandemic has shown a light on a lot of the fault lines in the medical system in this country that we've all known have been here for a long time. But now with the added burden of the pandemic, we can't ignore them anymore. And the emergency department gets used for a lot of non-emergent care. And we're happy to do that, but it is very costly to the system. And so, you know, one of the things that we are have been thinking about a lot in emergency medicine, both at my hospital and I think across the country, is how do we better provide the right care at the right time in the right place for patients without a costly emergency department visit. There are a lot of public health initiatives that I think are gaining traction now in the pandemic because emergency departments can't function as a safety net that they've always been able to be for this society. So I am hopeful. It's funny to say, but in the pandemic, I'm very hopeful that this will actually be a good thing for medicine because it'll force us to deal with some of these issues that have been here for decades.
Dr. Laura Foreman, Chief of Emergency Medicine at Kent Hospital in Warwick, Rhode Island. So today, we're going to try to understand why hospitals in the United States are overwhelmed right now. The answer isn't just the pandemic. It's something that came well before the pandemic. And we're going to try to learn what that is and if and how it can be fixed. And joining us today is Dr. Vivian Lee. She's president of health platforms at Verily Life Sciences. She's also author of The Long Fix, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. She's a senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement as well. Dr. Lee, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks. It's great to be with you, Meghna.
You know, I'll note that I think the last time we had you on the show was April 2020. So it's been almost 2 years now. Back then in April 2020, did you think we would still be talking about overwhelmed hospitals 2 years later?
I don't think any of us could have seen it, seen the course of these last 2 years evolve in the way that it has and still not be assured even today that we can see the end of that tunnel yet.
Well, you know what I'd like to do this hour? I'd like to sort of treat America's healthcare systems or hospitals more broadly as the patient, right? And we are going to do some exploratory surgery to try to understand what is ailing this patient. And so let's start narrowly. You heard Dr. Foreman there at the Kent Hospital Emergency Department in Rhode Island describe circumstances. Can you tell me, Dr. Lee, In an ideal case, non-pandemic times, how is an emergency department supposed to operate?
An emergency department, I think that the story that Dr. Foreman told is just really exemplifies these core challenges that we face in our healthcare system where, you know, we're not really a health system, we're a sickness system. And so what that means is that instead of being proactive about care, we're always reactive. So we really should only be relying on the emergency department for emergencies, as in the name. But in fact, because we have such a failing healthcare system, let's just take the fact that still about 9 or 10% of Americans right now have no access to health insurance, and maybe about 45% of Americans are underinsured. Now, for those who have no access to health insurance, they tend to, or who are underinsured, they tend to avoid care that is going to be costly to them. The out-of-pocket costs are just prohibitive. And so what could be prevented, say high blood pressure, could be managed with blood pressure medicines, diabetes could be better managed with their diabetes medications, instead turns into a crisis that lands them in the emergency department mm-hmm. with a stroke or with a heart attack. And so we end up seeing that about half of all admissions to the hospital are actually coming through the emergency department these days because, again, instead of being proactive, we're reactive. We wait until it builds into a crisis, which is, of course, bad for the patient, bad for the family, and certainly bad for the economics of healthcare as well.
Okay, so half of admissions coming into hospitals or coming or walking through or being or coming through the emergency department doors. Okay, so hold that thought for a second, because that automatically gets us into further upstream issues regarding health and healthcare in America. But I want to focus really on just the hospital operations for another few minutes with you, Dr. Lee, if I could, because until the pandemic, in not every place, but in many places, even with the that half of admissions that as you're talking about, the emergency departments were operating fairly well. I mean, you heard there that in Kent Hospital in Warwick, Rhode Island, for example, the waits were so short. The ER was operating so well that they even just closed their waiting room. So again, in ideal circumstances, what's the sort of mode of operation for an emergency room? People come in, they're supposed to get seen. There's, is the ER supposed to be full at all times so that the maximum number can be seen? I'm just trying to understand what a functioning system is supposed to look like.
Well, first of all, I have to say that Dr. Forman is a very skilled leader to have such an efficient emergency department. It is hard when the admissions and arrivals are so unpredictable mm-hmm. to be able to function so efficiently. But I think it does call out the fact that hospitals generally run on very thin margins. You know, the average hospital before the pandemic had an operating margin of maybe 2-3%. So, for example, the health system that I ran back in the University of Utah, we were about a $3.5 billion business. Most health systems are very expensive to run. You know, the physical facilities are expensive. And so operating on these razor-thin margins means that they're living pretty precariously, as we've seen during the pandemic. It's really toppled a lot of that balance. But it means that they've had to run really, really efficient operations.
Okay, and so Dr. Lee, hang on for just a second, because we're getting into the meat of things now, but we only have 20 seconds before the break. So we'll continue this when we come back. Today, with the help of Dr. Vivian Lee, we're trying to understand really what are the underlying causes that have led to hospitals being repeatedly overwhelmed over the course of the pandemic. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're trying to understand what's fundamental to America's hospital systems that was there before the pandemic that has led to the repeated crushing burden that the hospitals are bearing now and being overwhelmed over and over and over again as the pandemic grinds on. I'm joined today by Dr. Vivian Lee. She's president of Health Platforms at Verily Life Sciences and author of The Long Fix, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. Okay, so Dr. Lee, we're really going to rely for the next portion of the show here on your experience running a healthcare system in Utah. You said that in even in pre-pandemic circumstances, hospitals and hospital systems run on very thin operating margins, 2-3%. Can you just explain to folks what do you mean by that?
So the operating margin is just the amount of what's left over after the whole business has paid for all of its expenses. And so a 2-3% margin means that the vast majority of all of the funds that are collected for caring for patients is used to pay for the physicians, to pay for the nurses, to pay for the equipment, to pay for the hospital's operations. And so all that's left is about 2-3% of leftover, what you might call profit, but of course it's used to, say, invest in new buildings or new resources. And that is very thin compared to most other businesses that might operate on an 8 or 10% margin. And as a result, it makes the whole system very vulnerable. So as soon as you see, it means that you have to be much more efficient. So, for example, you have to have just enough staff, as Dr. Forman alluded to, in the emergency room. But if all of a sudden something unexpected happens, like a pandemic, and you're overwhelmed, you don't have much extra capacity because you've operated in such a lean, lean way that you just can't tolerate any unexpected developments.
Yeah. So, you know, the language that you're describing this with, in, to my ear, this is the language of manufacturing of a management, right? I mean, lean operations, just
That's
in time,
right.
Staffing or inventory, et cetera. I mean, is that how... Is that the sort of management thinking that has made its way into healthcare for reasons both, you know, bad and good?
Well, in some cases, yes. You know, the fundamental flaw of healthcare, I believe, is that our business model is set up to reward us in healthcare to do as many procedures and things to people as possible. We call it fee-for-service care. Mm-hmm. So in fee-for-service care, we are set up, we're programmed to try to optimize as many procedures as possible. And one avenue for that is to make sure that we have enough patients coming through our emergency rooms in order to do those operations and procedures. And so there are definitely parts of the hospital that are designed to be as optimally efficient as possible because they're the parts of the business that generate, quote, the revenue for that business. Other parts, I would say, for example, in thinking much more about primary care or prevention, have had a lot less focus because they're really not so profitable for the health systems. So I think the business model is really flawed. I mean, if you think about it, you know, in an ideal business model of healthcare, you'd rather have your doctor and your hospital bonused, you know, getting bonuses for keeping you well. But instead, actually, our healthcare system is set up to bonus the doctors and bonus the hospitals for doing an operation, for using a scalpel or using a needle. And so those parts are very lean and very optimally functioning. But the parts we'd rather have them focus on probably have been neglected.
Yeah. We'll talk more about maybe flipping the script on that or efforts to do so a little
Absolutely.
Later in the show. But Dr. Lee, you know, back in April of 2020, when you first came on the program, I offered up a metaphor that I actually thought was totally inappropriate. And you're like, nope, that's it. That's how you describe American healthcare. Because I said, it sounds like an airline. Right? Like that you don't want empty seats on an airplane. So you try to jam as many people in as possible with as few crew members now as possible that you can get away with in order to keep the plane safe and the passengers safe, of course. But like you got to get that plane off the ground and in the air. And you were like, no, that's pretty much how it works in hospitals, too. Do you still feel that way?
It is. And you know, what we're seeing now, though, is that even before the pandemic, having those few crew members working their tails off to try to, you know, keep all those seats filled, keep all the beds filled, has been really costly for the system. So even before the pandemic, we know that around 40 to 50% of physicians reported burnout. 40 to 50, nearly a half of all doctors reporting burnout. That's before the pandemic. And so now we're seeing, you know, we talk about the Great Resignation. It is really impacting healthcare in among the physicians and the nurses. And who can blame them, given everything that they've had to endure in the last couple of years? But that airline metaphor, if you just take it to the next step and imagine that those crew members have been working relentless shifts for the last 2 years, and then you can understand the real crisis that we're in healthcare.
Okay, So I think this is really, really important to help people understand. Right now, in many American hospitals, when we see that when we in the media say that the hospital is "quote unquote" overwhelmed, part of that is due to the Omicron surge, which is hopefully receding as we speak. But is the bigger part of the problem what you just said? Staffing burnout, or even quarantine requirements for hospital staff who may test positive, et cetera, that are just because we were already operating under those razor thin margins that not having even a few staff available has caused the overall system to become overwhelmed.
I think that we are at a tipping point in American healthcare right now, and the tip of the iceberg that we're really seeing is the overwhelmed workforce, for sure. But underneath fundamentally, we have this flawed business model. We have people who don't have access to health insurance. We have widening disparities of care. And all of the potential solutions, let's say technology, for example, helping us, digital solutions that could make our lives easier in healthcare, have not been fully realized yet. I mean, that's part of the long fix. That's part of the hope for the future. But we're seeing that all of these circumstances, which existed before the pandemic, they, as Dr. Forman alluded to, they're the fault lines that are really just massively emerging. And this is the moment when we really have to address those underlying challenges that we've had for the last several decades.
Okay.
It's time to fix it now.
Yeah. So let's, I want to hear from another physician, Dr. Jean Noble out in California. And earlier this month, she took a look at charts of every COVID positive patient at the University of California, San Francisco hospitals where she works. She did this on the 4th of January, and she determined, Dr. Noble determined, that at that time, on the 4th of January, 70% of the people in UCSF hospitals who had been identified as COVID positive were there for other reasons. So she wrote this email saying, quote, "The real COVID crisis that our hospitals are facing is a severe staffing shortage that is compromising the quality of our care." And the shortages caused by what things we've been talking about, Dr. Lee, by burnout. And at that time, Dr. Noble pointed out that staff were being told to stay home if they were asymptomatic but tested positive. So we checked in again with Dr. Noble. And again, she's a professor of emergency medicine at UCSF San Francisco.
Well, today we're okay. You know, today we have only a few people in our waiting room, and the patients who are coming in are getting beds in pretty short order. But it's been a bouncy ride. You know, we have pre-existing problems with flow. You know, our emergency department is not unique in this, but we have a problem with boarding, meaning that a third of our beds in the ER are often taken up with patients who are waiting for admission to the hospital floors. And those beds are not available for incoming emergency department patients. And that's a chronic systemic issue that is not unique to UCSF. But it does mean that we don't have a lot of capacity to surge when we do see an increase in patients coming in for whatever reason. You know, we are a lean and mean. You lose money if you are running an ICU at 50% capacity. Those are very expensive beds.
So we asked Dr. Noble if there was one thing, one systemic problem that could be fixed, what would that be?
It would have been to fix our boarding problem. It would be to have all of our emergency department beds at the disposal of emergency department patients at any one time. And that's a tall ask. That's a problem that's decades in the making, but we would have the ability to surge and see big increases in a volume of patients if we had all of our ER beds for ER patients.
Now, as you heard Dr. Noble describe a minute ago, boarding is when there are no beds available elsewhere in the hospital, so patients wait in the emergency department. And she says it's a huge problem that's caused by, once again, the fundamental way hospitals are run in the United States.
It's really complicated. There are a lot of different competing forces. And one of them at the very top is it's really expensive to have unused beds or staffed empty beds. So that's the design. The design is to operate at full capacity. And then there's also an issue, a national issue with a nursing shortage. So a hospital may have beds, but they are not staffed beds. There's in California, there's a 4-to-1 nurse to patient ratio, or one nurse has a maximum of 4 patients that they can take care of. And once they're exceeding that ratio, if there's not another nurse to take care of the patient in the 5th bed, that bed will remain empty. That happens a lot, and that's a real problem.
That's Dr. Jean Noble, an emergency room physician and professor of emergency medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Vivian Lee, your response to what Dr. Noble there described about, first of all, the problem of boarding.
Well, boarding is a consequence of, just as we talked about before, not really being able to predict how many visits you're going to have in any given time and not having any extra capacity because we're operating so lean. And when I hear that, it reminds me that today, really, a lot of the challenge is because of the COVID pandemic. And we do have, you know, ordinarily, when you know that there's going to be crisis or you have a sense that there's going to be some kind of a unpredictability, you want to create some early warning systems. You know what you want to, like the meteorology service helps us anticipate a hurricane that might be brewing first as a tropical storm. And in the case of COVID, we have now, having done cycle after cycle of it, we know that there are actually very effective early warning systems that could be put into place if we had a more functional public health system. There are really excellent wastewater programs now that enable us to detect very early on these surveillance studies of early infectious diseases, for example. So that would help us better anticipate the needs in emergency departments. The other part of the boarding problem is not having enough beds in the hospital. Mm. And there, you know, because our business model has so favored having patients in the hospital, that's where you generate the most money. That's where there's the most profit. We haven't actually embraced a lot of these models that have been picked up in other parts of the world, like in the UK and in Australia and Japan, of encouraging some of the care that can be done and taken care of at home to move to the home. For example, patients who may need an infusion of intravenously, for example, of antibiotics for several days. Most of that can be done actually in the home setting very safely and actually even more comfortably for patients, provided nurses can, say, go and visit them in the home. And that can actually offload some of that pressure for beds in the hospital. So on both ends, on the receiving end in the emergency department, we could do better in anticipating. And then similarly, we could actually do better at getting patients out of the hospital or some patients out of the hospital who don't actually need to be there.
So you just described something that sounds like it's a long way off in terms of becoming a regular part of the American healthcare system. But we need to be aiming for those things. I just want to pull the focus back a little bit closer to the emergency that hospitals are experiencing right now for another minute, Dr. Lee, if we could. Another thing that Dr. Noble in San Francisco was saying is, again, just in managing the pandemic and the current crisis, she said that emergency departments are flooded with the worried well, as she called them, that are simply seeking testing and reassurance. Now, you know, if one of the things that we need to do right now is to keep people who don't need emergency care out of the ER, like how do we better manage that when people feel like they have nowhere else to go to just get a test?
Well, actually, I feel like a lot of the home care opportunities are actually even a reality today.
Okay.
And they play out in terms of the patients that you're talking about now. So we had this experience actually within Verily, because one of our businesses is in this space of a digital health program, digital health platform. So for people who have conditions like diabetes, like hypertension, like depression, so on, it's perfectly possible. It's actually really even preferential for many of these individuals to just have the information and be able to look after their own health in their own homes, but with the ability to text with a clinician or video conference, do what we call telehealth with a doctor, with a nurse, with a dietitian, some kind of a clinician that they have a relationship with. That's available today. Now, until the COVID pandemic, many of these programs were not reimbursed by insurance companies or by Medicare. But since the pandemic, the tide has turned, and we've come to see that actually it's a more effective way. Not all care has to take place within the four walls of the clinics or in the emergency department, as you described. Much of it can be done outside and actually at the convenience of individuals, especially if they can just text. If they have a concern, text with a coach or set up a quick video conference with them. It's much more cost effective in many of these settings.
Hmm. Okay. So for the rest of the show, after we take our next break in about a minute, I want to hear more about other changes that we need to make in order to, you know, fundamentally adjust the system to make it more resilient in the best of times and in the worst of times. But just for for another minute here, what other aspects of emergency care right now, since we've been focusing so much on that first place that people walk into the hospital, what other things do you think need to be changed right now to help emergency departments? We're already seeing some relaxation in the rules of, doctors who are asymptomatic but test positive. Some of them are being allowed back in to work because the staffing needs are so dire. What do you think about that?
Yeah, the staffing crisis is definitely one that we need to address. But I think one step that many communities have taken is better coordination across all of the emergency departments in their community. Traditionally, these hospitals have been competitive, but increasingly being able to coordinate, say, hey, you have a few extra beds, let me send some of these patients over to you so that we can manage as a community more effectively.
Well, we'll talk about how maybe to improve on that system as well. And by the way, I noticed I kept saying doctors. Of course, it's not just doctors. It's doctors, nurses, and all the healthcare professionals that hospitals and we rely on. So forgive my shorthand of just saying doctors. I mean all of you out there. So Dr. Vivian Lee, stand by for a second. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to understand exactly what are the fundamentals in American healthcare, but specifically in American hospitals that have led to them being repeatedly overwhelmed in this COVID pandemic. And I'm joined today by Dr. Vivian Lee. She's president of Health Platforms at Verily Life Sciences. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School and a senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and author of The Long Fix, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. Now, Dr. Lee, before the break, you were talking about physicians sort of or medical staff working together in, say, regional hospitals to try to find beds when patients need them. I'm wondering if there's a way to improve on even just that practice right now in the United States, because Dylan Scott, a healthcare reporter at Vox, told us that in Canada and certain European countries, there's a different entity entirely, a government ministry that finds beds for patients when a hospital ER is full. So maybe the doctors or nurses themselves don't have to be the ones sleuthing around for beds. So is there room for improvement here on that in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. I think we were all really envying those systems in the last couple of years. They haven't really been set up because these systems have been so competitive. Our healthcare business is really a very competitive industry. And so traditionally that kind of coordination collaboration hasn't existed. But I'm hopeful that through the pandemic, some of the connections that have been made will continue to persist even post-pandemic and enable more coordination so we can be more resilient as communities, you know, rather than hospital by hospital.
Mm. You know, we're getting some comments here, folks who want us to maybe check a little bit about our presumptions regarding how this has been going in other countries. Because Ray Russell says the so-called free taxpayer-supported systems abroad have larger issues, which include severe staff shortages, extended wait times to see specialists, etc. When it comes to healthcare, there is no free lunch. Dr. Lee, just keeping it within the pandemic context, I mean, how would you compare how U.S. hospitals have done in comparison to, say, various European nations?
Well, I feel like we have – it's such a mixed story because on the one hand, we have to celebrate the really rapid speed and sharing of learnings about COVID early on, such as the need to, for example, fit flip patients onto their stomachs, for example, for better aeration of their lungs. I don't know if you remember some of that early reporting with COVID. Just, we were on the web all the time with webinars and people sort of sharing their learnings. And that was happening globally. But particularly, I want to say that the American systems really stepped up and shared. And that was brilliant. The development of the vaccines was unbelievable. I mean, just a remarkable achievement to be able by the end of 2020 to actually have thousands of people in this country receiving a completely novel kind of vaccine with the mRNA technology. I mean, that was scientifically just unbelievable, just really, really impressive. So there are many things I think we can celebrate, and I think we should celebrate them, and just the heroic effort of our frontline clinicians, as you alluded to before the break. I mean, just really, it's an amazing team effort. Fundamentally, the underlying healthcare system, though, I would say in the U.S. falls far short compared to other high-income nations. And this is really based on just paper after paper, publication, analysis after analysis, that we tend to cost a lot more. We tend to have poorer outcomes in this country compared to other nations. And overall, the trajectory is actually, unfortunately, going down. You know, for the first time in forever, in the last several years, we've seen life expectancy in the U.S. actually go down, decline, despite better healthcare and drugs and, you know, all these kind of scientific advances. So as a system, fundamentally, we're on pretty shaky grounds here in the U.S. compared to others. I don't think any system is perfect, and I understand that comment, but we have a long ways to go in this country, especially given how much we spend on healthcare.
Well, you had pointed, though, to some improvements that the pandemic has forced, really, here in the United States. Telehealth, or much more expansive use of telehealth. And did I hear you mention even sort of more at-home visits for healthcare providers coming to people's homes and perhaps even performing certain tests there? Or is that something you would like to see more in the United States?
No, actually, we are seeing more of that. So, you know, one of the reasons why I call my book The Long Fix is actually because I'm quite optimistic, or I try to be as optimistic as possible. And one of the consequences of the COVID pandemic is actually that some of these newer models are taking hold. So for example, in the Medicare business, traditionally Medicare has been fee for service. And it just means that, you know, doctors get paid every time they do something to people. But there's been a growing segment of the Medicare market called Medicare Advantage. About a third of all seniors now are in a Medicare Advantage program. And during the pandemic, what we saw in the Medicare Advantage model, which pays doctors differently, it rewards doctors for keeping people healthy. And so in those Medicare Advantage medical groups, when they were caring for their seniors, they actually took the dollars from Medicare and said, oh, you know what, let's think about our seniors and keep them healthier by, for example, delivering their medications to their homes, sending nurses out to their homes, maybe taking our clinics and converting them to an urgent care setting so our patients don't have to go to a scary emergency department, instead can come into the clinic for urgent things that are happening to them. So this model of using those dollars to do more home care, as you alluded to, Meghna, and other more proactive preventative measures, it is happening today. And we've seen it move much more quickly since the pandemic, because people are coming to realize that our old business model really, really hasn't served us that well, especially during this crisis.
You know, I don't mean to make light of this, but it sounds like all of a sudden what popped into my head was that show Call the Midwife. Have you ever seen that show?
Oh, no, so, I haven't.
So you can stream it now. It first started on PBS, and it's basically based on the diaries of a British midwife just after the Second World War, in the earliest days of the NHS there, working in London's East End, and she was a district nurse. They would go, that their jobs were to go to people's homes to provide primary care in their homes, right? That's literally what the model was in the 50s and 60s in the United Kingdom. They would do all the things that you just said. They would do tests, they would deliver medicines, they would provide, you know, non-urgent care. So in a sense, we're kind of, maybe does part of the solution here in the United States is embracing something that's a little older rather than newer. Yeah, go ahead.
Absolutely. Actually, what they've done in London, I was a student of this a few years back because I really wanted to bring it here to the U.S. They've actually taken what you've just described with the midwives and actually moved it even further to actually taking hospitalized patients or patients who would normally have been hospitalized and actually caring for them in the home. So they actually have in London a system where instead of calling 911, you know, or their equivalent of 911, it actually, the phone calls get triaged to some nurses. And the nurses do an assessment, you know, obviously crushing chest pain. It's a terrible heart attack. They have to come straight into the emergency department. There's no question about that. But in some cases, they actually don't need to come to the emergency room. Maybe they're concerned, but they don't have severe vital sign abnormalities, you know, they have a severe symptoms. And so the nurses within 1 or 2 hours make their way to the patient's home, do the assessment, and then determine whether they need to have an ambulance, for example, bring them in, or whether they can receive that care at home. And then they go and they check on them daily. And what's really remarkable to me is most of that work was done with paper and pencil kind of technology. And so what we were looking at and what we're looking at even now today, I think across the technology landscape is how can we really enable that and facilitate that and even accelerate that with technology, with home monitoring, with sensors, with telehealth, you know, video conferencing, for example. And so I think what is already a reality in, say, London or in Australia, parts of Australia, could definitely be done here in the U.S., provided the payers, the insurance companies, Medicare, for example, encouraged that development.
Okay, because I was just going to ask you, and maybe you just provided a little bit of an answer in that, would it cost more? Because it sounds like this, in this subset of solutions, if ultimately we want to send people to folks' homes, even if we use those technologies you're talking about, would that add to the financial burden that the U.S. healthcare system is already weighed down under?
Well, actually, it turns out that it's significantly less expensive. And we've already seen this take place. I don't want to make this sound like something that is far out in the future. It's actually happening in many forms today in this country. So where it first took hold was in the orthopedics area, where patients who are undergoing, for example, a hip replacement or a knee replacement, ordinarily, I mean, back when I was training, for example, those patients would stay in the hospital for several days, maybe more than a week or so to recover. And these days, very typically, very ordinarily, a patient might go home even the same day of their operation or the next morning. And the reason why that's possible is because these orthopedic surgeons and surgery groups have set up for physical therapists to go home, for nurses to go home, for the pain management team to manage and provide that pain care for patients at home, and to do so in a way that actually keeps patients safer. They do better in their homes generally. People are more familiar. They're less likely to fall, for example, in their homes, provided they have the support. And the data are consistently showing better outcomes and lower costs, significantly lower costs of care.
Lower costs of care because the hospital is the expensive place?
The hospital is the expensive place. And hospitals are where mistakes happen. People fall in hospitals. They get confused. They get up in the night. They don't remember that they're in the hospital. They fall on their way to the bathroom, for example. And so those mistakes, those complications, are very costly. So it's actually less, it's safer and less expensive in the home.
So we've got about 5 minutes left, Dr. Lee. And sort of now we're really at the, I'm amazed and hopeful with a lot of the solutions that you've presented to us here and would love to see them take hold across the country. Just to note, so that people don't think we're not thinking about these things, there are lots of places in the United States where hospital systems have shrunk, right? There may be one hospital serving vast numbers of counties, and healthcare is hard to access as it is. I'm thinking about especially in rural America. So, you know, this is not something that we can just snap our fingers and everything will be better. And
that's true.
But in addition, when we're thinking about the system overall, my mind keeps jumping back to the language that I was using, that we were using at the top of the show about efficiencies and margins. And I'm just wondering, given the fee-for-service world that you're talking about that we still live in the United States, I mean, is that a system that will tolerate more inefficiencies, if that's part of the solution to our healthcare problem. And maybe I shouldn't even use that word inefficiencies because it like puts us in the wrong mind frame. Will it tolerate having more slack or more resilience if we're still in a fee for health, fee for service world?
Well, I think fundamentally, it's not only my opinion, but I think the opinion of most health leaders on both sides of the aisle is that we need to change that business model. That the business model of fee-for-service has just been leading to more and more high-end utilization of care, sometimes not necessary, at the expense of primary care and public health and all the things that we've seen fall short during the COVID pandemic. And so if we continue on this path that we're already on, so everything that I described about Medicare moving more and more to Medicare Advantage, those yeah. kinds of trends are already underway. And as I said, they've been supported under both parties vigorously. So if we can continue to do that, then the market forces in this country, whether it's the drive to efficiency, the drive to profitability, whatever it is, will push us to create and continue to innovate in ways that will lead to better health. We will be bonusing doctors and hospitals for keeping us healthy. And the way in which they will become profitable or continue to be profitable is by leveraging technology. The technology transfer that's happened, the transformation that's happened in every other industry has yet to really take hold in healthcare. I mean, think about the way you bank today compared to how you might have banked 20 years ago, for example. You know, we never really have to go into a bank anymore. We can do everything at home. We can manage our financial health, deposit checks, figure out our balances, make our payments all automatically. Imagine if we could do that much, much more across healthcare. If my kid has a rash, I don't need to drive them in to see a pediatrician. I can take a picture. Maybe the artificial intelligence on the picture can tell me if that rash is infectious or not, or I can at least send it over to the pediatrician or the dermatologist and I can know whether to go to school or not. There's so many things that I could be doing that could lower the utilization. I could use much better predictive analytics and be able to say, you know what? This family is at higher risk of developing this cancer. Let's get them in for early screening so they don't develop the cancer. That technology is available today. Mm. So all we need to do is create the economic incentives, the business models, or continue to move forward. I shouldn't say create because we're already down that path, but let's accelerate that and let that innovation really drive us forward.
Well, it seems that the pandemic may be forcing some of that. But Dr. Lee, we have 1 minute left and I really want to get one last question here to you. You know, my education is actually as an engineer, so I keep thinking about this word efficiency and tolerances, and they mean something particular to me. Like, you know, operational efficiencies are best used in an environment where things are predictable, right? You can hold to that Six Sigma envelope if you know what you're making every single time. But healthcare, by definition, you're dealing with human beings and their health. I would say, by definition, it's an unpredictable system. So shouldn't we build in tolerance for quote-unquote inefficiencies in order to be resilient in a system that's fundamentally unpredictable?
You're right that it is fundamentally unpredictable, but the tools and technologies we have to manage it more effectively are not being used today. Okay. We could be better at predicting. We don't have to completely be blindsided by every new COVID variant. We know what's going to happen. So why not use that information to make ourselves just a little bit more resilient, yeah. a little bit more robust? We have a lot of progress that we can make already today, and I want us to make that progress.
Well, Dr. Vivian Lee, author of The Long Fix, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. She's also president of health platforms at Verily Life Sciences. Dr. Lee, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magda.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.